Amita, can you hear me? Let's take a roll call and see how close we are to membership attendance and
okay.
Quorum.
All right. Justice Hardesty?
Present.
Okay. Justice Hernan?
Yes.
Excellent. Mr. Scott has stepped out. Judge Burton? Judge Clark Newberry?
I am present.
Thank you. Mike Doan? Judge Dollinger?
Present.
Thank you. Steve Grierson? Judge Hill will not be attending today. Darren Imlay?
Here.
Thank you. Judge Jones?
Here.
Thank you. Christopher Lally?
I'm present.
Thank you. Alicia LaRude?
Present.
Thank you. Judge Lee Young? Judge Matthews?
Present.
Thank you. Chris Long?
Present.
Thank you. Leslie Nino Piro?
Present.
Thank you. Jennifer Noble? Professor Regalia? Judge Saragossa will also not be here today. Judge Sullivan? Judge Tyrus?
Here.
Thank you. And Judge Tyrell?
Present.
Thank you. We do have a quorum today.
Okay, well, welcome everybody, and thank you all for your participation. Is there anyone who's participating in the meeting or on the call whose name was not called, but we should record as a participant in the meeting?
I'm Jonelle Thomas, Special Public Defender in Clark County.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Let me begin with a couple of opening comments, and then I'll turn it over to my co-chair, Justice Herndon, to comment if he has anything further he'd like to add. I'd like to begin by thanking the subcommittees for their work in developing these graphs or descriptions of case events within case types. I thought the work was really outstanding, and I'd like to also thank the AOC and its folks for developing, circulating, and tabulating all of the results that we received to the survey of attorneys, and then we did a separate survey of judges. This is a generalization, but I would say by and large, there was quite a bit of similarity from my point of view in a number of areas in the responses that we received from the judges as well as the attorneys throughout the state. I must say I was really impressed with the size of the response by attorneys. Statistically, by any measure, that was very impressive and reliable in every area of the state, Rurals, Washoe, and Clark. So I think the committee has before it some valuable insight about what the bar and the judges think about the rules associated with virtual hearings. I think we also have some entertaining comments, if not altogether insightful, but candid for sure in some areas. So with that, I wanted to kind of reorder our approach to our discussion today. First, asking if there were any members of the commission who wanted to discuss, comment, or ask questions about the surveys and their results. And then move separately to the each of the separate subcommittee summaries and get people's reactions and comments about the breakdown of those summaries and some of the comments that are in the comments section of those. My understanding, could be incorrect, but my understanding is that the graphs that have been presented come to the whole commission on the recommendation of each of the subcommittee members. Each subcommittee has recommended that you approach the rules for virtual hearing based upon each subcommittee's recommendation. So with that said, we'll see what we might be able to achieve today as we start down the rulemaking process. This is December the 2nd. So for me, time is running fast. I would love to be a part of the completion of the work of the commission, but that's why we have a co-chair and a soon-to-be chair in Justice Herndon. Rushed is not important. What is important is to arrive at an appropriate statewide policy in each of these areas. So whatever that takes to accomplish, I'm sure that's what Justice Herndon and the rest of the commission would like to see. So we'll see where we go from here after we've had some discussions on these subparts. Justice Herndon, anything you'd like to add to this overview?
Well, the first thing I would add is, man, I'm going to miss you. Not just in terms of how great you've been at a judge and justice and a friend, but your work on commissions like this one has been extraordinary. And your wisdom and institutional knowledge is going to be sorely missed. So, and I'm sure everybody on this committee and commission and all the subcommittees would thank you for everything you've done as well. I don't know if this is the last one we're winding down. My sense is the Water Court Commission is probably not yet done. But yeah, we're going to miss you, my friend, for sure. As far as the commission is concerned, I shared a lot of the comments that you already made. I was really pleased to see how many people weighed in, both from a practitioner standpoint and a judge standpoint. And I agree that there were some very entertaining comments. As I said last night in my email, the in-person being a BMW versus virtual court being a perfectly acceptable Honda was quite the analogy, and I'm not quite sure who made it, but I enjoyed reading that. But I also agree that there seemed to really be a lot of similarity in what people were thinking in terms of when we need to be focusing on presumptively being in court in person versus all the areas where we can default to maybe presumptively virtual to the benefit of attorneys or clients and the public. So I have a sense that we're going to probably get to a lot of decision-making fairly easily on how to come up with some rules, just because I think everybody was really open-minded about it and does share very similar views on that.
Okay, well, let's turn to item 5 and the materials that are attached, and they're really voluminous. But I wanted to see if any of the commission members had any questions, comments, assessments, takeaways with respect to the survey results that we provided in the materials. And if so, we can look into that and get your views and your thoughts about that. And then from that, we'll turn our attention to item 4 on the agenda and go through each of the subcommittee graphs that have been prepared and the comments within those graphs.
Jim, are we talking about the virtual hearing survey results for judicial officers or practitioners, or just kind of all together at once?
Let's break them down first by practitioners.
Okay.
Does anybody have any comments about the surveys?
Justice Hardesty, good afternoon. Sorry to interrupt.
No, please do.
Thank you.
That's what this is about.
For those that don't know me, my name is Barry Breslow. I'm a district judge here in Washoe County, Department 8. And Your Honor, if you would allow me to, I would appreciate the opportunity to make a short bit of public comment about the results of the surveys and some insights that I'd like to share. If now is not the time, I'll certainly wait to my place in line.
No, please proceed.
Thank you. Let me preliminarily make one more lighthearted comment, and that's this. We're in the middle of the World Cup, where we all know the most prominent accomplished players are known singularly by their last name, Ronaldo, Messi. So I'm very happy to join this meeting and see Justices Hardesty and Herndon identified solely by their surname in light of the World Cup going on outside. Okay, so I know you have a lot to do. I want to, first of all, thank the commission for its hard work and, of course, the subcommittees, both the civil, family, and criminal justice for their efforts to help put into place some presumptive appearance rules that can guide practitioners, participants, and judges. You may recognize that one of the judicial commentators to the survey was known as the 8 compelling reasons judge. Now, I was not like Justice of the Peace Dreiling, who was bold enough to put my name to my strong opinions, but I do so now. I was the 8 compelling reasons judge, the 8 compelling reasons to tread very carefully, lightly, and conservatively on any presumptive appearance for virtual advocacy recommendations. Here's why. As having been a judicial law clerk myself years ago for Judge McKibben, having been a civil litigator for 29 years throughout the state and throughout the country, having presided over 5,000 criminal justice matters, hundreds of civil matters, administrative matters, having been the mental health court presiding judge, having been the arbitration presiding judge, and having tried many cases myself, I think I have a basis to make these comments. So here they go. Virtual advocacy, in my opinion, limits a judicial officer's ability to communicate effectively and thoroughly with their court staff, law clerk, court reporter in real time to get information, to direct some research, to assist the judicial officer in doing their job. It also interferes with the ability to get a true sense of the person testifying. Our job is usually done in 3 dimensions, and to do it virtually in 2 limits, inhibits, and restricts the ability of the evaluator to get a sense of the truthfulness and credibility of the person who is speaking. The second issue is virtual advocacy in the last 2.5 years, in my view, has significantly impaired the respect for the judiciary and the judicial process. People walk in and out of their camera view. They don't dress like they should. They don't prepare like they should. They don't use the same words, the same language, the same approach as they ought to. Remembering, of course, that the courthouse is both a place and a process. And the process is to administer fairly the matters that come before the court. The place, though, should inspire respect for the rule of law and for the judiciary. And you lose that in my humble opinion, quite a bit doing virtual advocacy, especially if you do it from a place as a judicial officer other than in the courthouse. I just feel that has brought down in the eyes of the public and the participants the stature of the judiciary quite a bit. I also would note that it interferes with the ability there are technology challenges, I should say. Yesterday, I had a big hearing on a wrongful death case, and I allowed counsel one side to appear remotely from another town. And the call got dropped and it took 20 minutes to reconnect. And so that is probably something that we've all experienced. And frankly, is that manageable? Sure, but it's not optimal. I'd also mention Zoom fatigue. It's hard to look at all these people all the time. The studies show that eyes get tired, brains get tired. It's hard to both handle the technology, keep your eyes moving around the room, and do your job at the same time. It limits courthouse interaction, remembering, of course, that a judicial officer's job is not just to fairly preside over the matters in front of him or her. It's also to get out into the community and do judicial outreach. And that you can't do that if you are holding virtual court from a place other than the courthouse. You cannot walk down the hall, check in on the law clerks, ask them how their job is going, what their career path looks like. Maybe they should come watch your court. Let's go take a trip to Step 2, to Crossroads, to the Empowerment Center. Go to one of the high schools locally, one of the middle schools, to inspire greatness in the students there. I mean, that is our job. That is, in my view, equally important to our role as judicial officers than to adjudicate the cases that come in front of us. And virtual advocacy has limited greatly, in my view, the ability and willingness of judicial officers to do that. And again, my humble opinion, half of the job is to inspire. And so it's not just to fairly adjudicate the matters in front of us. Finally, what I would say is that there certainly is a need, certainly, I'm stating the obvious, the sky's blue. There's a need to do things remotely in many cases where it can be done as efficiently, at less cost, and increase the access to justice. I only caution everyone, whatever the recommendations are, that while we increase the access to justice, we do not diminish its effectiveness. And for multiple reasons, after doing Zoom for 2.5 years, thousands of hearings, I can tell you it is not the same quality of justice. It's not. Maybe we will get there, but it's, in this humble judge's opinion, a long, long way. And the default browser should be not to have virtual courts. We should, the default position on most of these civil and criminal justice subcommittee proposed rules should be to do it in person in three dimension. You know, attorneys have to build their skill set of advocacy and trial preparation and introduction of evidence. There are 5 jury trials starting in this courthouse on Monday. That's one of the reasons I'm here right now, getting ready for the very serious criminal justice trial that starts here on Monday morning. But I'm one of 5, and I have noticed these newer attorneys, these younger attorneys, they do not have quite the mentoring, quite the experience, or the skill set that you would expect to see. And part of that is because they've been doing court at home for the last 2.5 years. So let me end this and get everyone back to the regularly scheduled program. But I want to say thank you to the commission. This is valuable work. It needs to be done. I want to say especially thank you to the subcommittee for all your efforts. But bear in mind that some of the proposed virtual default position or presumption of presumptive appearance virtually, I would respectfully ask you to reconsider. I just believe that some of these need to be done in person. If you want 2 or 3 that I noticed that I would say I would strongly disagree on the civil side, it's status conferences, trial readiness conferences. It appears that the recommendation will be virtual. No. In my department, the final pretrial conference before trial, lead trial attorneys need to be there and clients. How come? We show them the setup of the courtroom. We explain court hours. We show them where the bathroom is. We show them, they test the computers to make sure everything works. We tell them the do's and don'ts. We impress upon them the seriousness of the matter that's coming before them. We let the parties talk if they want to have, maybe they've never seen each other before in these civil disputes. And so to do a readiness for trial conference virtually, no, we would lose quite a bit of the effectiveness of the courthouse and the judicial process. So strongly disagree with that. On the criminal justice side, to do arraignments virtually, same thing. Many times now on arraignments, we're getting requests to change custody status. And to get a sense of whether that's a good idea, I need to size up the person whose custody status is going to be changed. What do they look like? How are they acting? Get to know them a little bit. Find out where they're going to live, who's going to vouch for them, what they're going to be doing. I can't do that well in two dimensions. And is it a meaningful Honda or a, you know, good enough Honda? No, respectfully, it is not. It's a broken down Honda. And if it's going to drive well, it needs to be well-maintained. And well-maintained means get the person who wants to be released or have their custody status changed in the courtroom so we can measure them up. Okay, I will stop talking. Justice Hardesty, Justice Herndon, thank you for doing what you do. To the rest of you on the subcommittee and the administrators, thank you so much for this, the excellent work you're doing on this. And to everyone, I wish you a very pleasant holiday season. Justice Hardesty, unless you, for any reason, need me, I'll just watch quietly from this point forward.
Well, let me offer a couple of observations, and there's no reason to proceed quietly when you do that. I do want to make a distinction between where the virtual hearings are hosted versus the conduct or the matters to be conducted by virtual hearings. And to me, that's an important distinction. It is one that has developed, I think, since we've come out of COVID. In my view, judges need to be in their courtroom conducting any hearing, virtual or otherwise, because the public has a right to come to an open courthouse and observe the proceedings. So I am unalterably opposed, even in my short remaining time, to the conduct of virtual hearings by the judge, master, hearing officer from their home. I also believe, as you suggest, Judge Breslow, that if you and your staff are in the courtroom where you belong, the communication challenges that you referenced with respect to the staff, and I was a district court judge, I understand some of those issues, are mitigated, in fact, eliminated. So the public has a right to come to the courthouse and observe the proceedings. There are also litigants who have a right to attend those hearings in person if they choose to do so. But I do think that there is a lot of cases and a lot of case types that can be handled virtually that the practitioners recognize and many judges recognize are far more efficient and don't require the kind of 3D observation that you mentioned. Now, admittedly, reasonable people can differ about this, but I do think the threshold question that the commission will have to ask is when the court is in session holding hearings, regardless of the hearing type, should the court be in the court, should the judge be in the courthouse, the hearing officer, be it the judicial officer, be in the courthouse with their staff, or can they do this from their office at home? I, for one, believe that our Constitution, our statute compel us to be in the courthouse. And if that's the starting point, then what we're talking about is the handling of matters from the courthouse and building rules around those matters. Now, you've covered a number of other points, Judge Breslow. I want to extend to any commissioner an opportunity to comment on your comments or others or mine. But I would urge that the commission divide this issue into where it's hosted before we talk about what is being presumptively virtually heard. And it would be interesting to hear from other commissioners about where the judge should be. Now, I will admit, on emergencies or warrants, that's a those are different situations. They're unusual. But I think by and large, what we're talking about is the conduct of proceedings that are on the big list that has been circulated. Justice Herndon.
Yeah, first off, I agree with you. And I think everybody on my committee, thankfully, agreed with that as well, because that was kind of a starting point for me. And the comments on our report was judges shall be in the courtroom with court staff. And the only thing I was going to add was when you said the public's right to come, one of the things that we recognized as well is there's a lot of times where crime victims, criminal defendants, civil parties, they want to come to court. And they should always have the right, even if something is presumptually virtual, to come to court. And the only reason they're going to want to come to court is because the judge is going to be there, and they're going to want that interpersonal interaction as part of their case if they need to speak to the court. And they shouldn't be coming to court and seeing a judge sitting on their couch, right? I mean, it's just the judges need to be in the courtroom for no matter what the hearings are. And I don't disagree with that kind of being our starting premise that we need to establish as to where the judges and staff will be for these hearings.
Okay, any other comments, observations about the surveys or some of the discussion we've had thus far?
Justice Hardesty, Judge Matthews.
Hi.
Hello. Does the panel believe that the judges should be in the courtroom for the bail hearings that occur on weekends and holidays, and or I'll use a prime example in the rural areas where we are currently struggling to get judge pro tems and or coverages when we're out or sick. I was very ill this week. I had a hearing that could not be moved. It's the first time I've actually held a court hearing of that magnitude from the home, but I couldn't find a judge to get it. Does the commission feel that there should be some exceptions in there, or do they feel that even the bail hearing should be at home? we may have a 5-minute hearing.
Sure, and I would open this to discussion more broadly, but I make two observations about that. Obviously, when there are people who are ill and warrants being sought at 3 a.m, those kinds of things, those are exceptions in my mind. I don't know about the rest of the commission, but as to the bail hearings, we need to keep in mind that victims of crime have a right to observe those proceedings. So unless you're going to invite them to your house, that's a problem. I would also add that in a lot of bail cases, there are security issues. I don't know how those security issues get handled unless the bail hearing occurs from the jail. And in some of our jails around the state, I don't think that they're connected in a way where that can be handled. So I think it has to be in court.
So Justice Hardesty, if I may, in Lyon County, the bail hearings, all inmates are at the jail.
Mm-hmm.
And we allow the victims always to appear virtually as well. Just for something to consider. I also believe to a great extent that the judge should be in the courtroom. I do not believe I should be holding court from my couch either, sir. But I think that we have to consider the rural areas and some of the obstacles that we have. Some of the courts have one clerk. We're expected to be holding hearings 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to piece together the best that we can to meet the mandates that we're facing. So I would hate to see this commission say the judge and their staff absolutely have to be in the courtroom. I think it would become a hindrance for the rules.
Judge Breslow, are you all doing bail hearings? Are your defendants up at par, or they come into the courthouse?
So I have not done a bail hearing with a defendant up in the jail for two reasons. One, almost all the bail hearings, other than special circumstances, Johnston case that just came out, and first look bail hearings, are usually handled by justices of the peace. So in 98% of the cases, I do never hold a bail hearing. On the 2% that the court is directed to or needs to, they've been in person.
And in Clark County, most all of the bail hearings are being done in the courthouse in the basement still, or Just the arraignments, I guess. Bail hearings are in justice court.
Initial appearance. This is Darren Emily in Clark County. Mm-hmm. Initial appearance court for the Las Vegas Justice Courts, that is done in person 7 days a week. The rurals for Henderson, North Las Vegas, and the outers, that is done virtually. Judges, I don't know necessarily, are always in the courtroom for those. Judge Terrell may want to respond to the rurals.
Hey, Darren, this is Doug Herndon. When you said they're done in person 7 days a week, what is that? What do you mean by in person? Like
on everybody is in the courtroom.
Okay.
In Las Vegas Justice Court.
Okay.
In the rurals, the attorney is in a different area than the defendant, and the court's in a different area. So those aren't done in court on weekends. Monday through Thursday, they are done in the courtroom. In Henderson and North Las Vegas, the outers are still done virtually because you may have court going on in Laughlin and a hearing in Mesquite.
Got it.
So Judge Herndon, I've checked with our deputies who appear on those matters virtually, and I'm being told that for the most part, judges are appearing in the courthouse or in their chambers. So it is done. It seems almost in all cases from the courthouse. And Judge Tyrell would know because she's fortunate enough to conduct these hearings.
Yeah, I was focusing.
We are now doing all of them in the courtroom 7 days a week. When we were first getting started with the process, we were doing some of them from our home offices, but we are now doing 7 days a week from the courthouse.
If I may just throw one partial scenario out, in Lyon County, our geographically, how spread out we are, we have three justice courts, three JPs, we have a mini court that helps with the weekend rotations. We rotate one every 4 weeks. We are handling all three courts at the same time. In order to hold hearings in person, the jail would have to transport the inmates that need to be seen to Dayton, the inmates that need to be seen to Fernley, and the inmates that need to be seen in Yerington. And we don't have the funds or the personnel to do those transports on the weekend, on the days. There's three different locations that they have to go to, just as another thought to think of.
But the judge is in the courthouse.
No, not always. The judge is not always in the courthouse, no, sir. On the weekend, on the weekdays, yes, sir, we are on the bench at the courthouse for any and all virtual hearings that occur. The judges are on the bench. It's the weekend hearings only.
Lori, I apologize, because when I was making my initial comment, I was just kind of focusing on work week stuff. I wasn't trying to get into focusing on whatever any jurisdiction needs to do to best accomplish their weekend bail hearing requirements. I get that, particularly in the rurals, that's going to be a little different. And so maybe the commission needs to recognize that we're practical on weekend court. The judge needs to be in the courthouse, and that might not always be practical.
Thank you, Justice Herndon.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I agree with that. Any other comments or observations? I will, just as an aside, I sat in with Justice Peace Graham to watch the IA court twice. It was quite interesting, very effective. I was really impressed. And all of that was live and in person, but that was during the weekday.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Hardesty, had a comment.
Yes,
I think what we had discussed in our subcommittee was that a shall or must takes away those exceptions, and that the presumption should be that the judge should be in the courthouse. And I think we all were in agreement. But there are those emergent situations, or what Judge Mathis was discussing, that having language that allows for those exceptions and emergencies and the discretion of the judge, you know, is important, that the rule accommodates for that. While the presumption should be the judge should always be in the courtroom, there are those instances. And so that's my only concern, is that, and especially in light of understanding the rules, you know, having a statewide rule that might be very accommodating to, you know, we have a lot of judges that can cover for each other here in Clark County, but I can use an example. I recently, but had to appear virtually because while I could have got coverage, I spent hours preparing for a hearing and had an emergency literally 5 minutes before leaving the house to get to the courthouse. And it just, it would be unfair to burden one of my colleagues and a situation where moving the hearing would have caused great prejudice to the parties and to the defendants. And so in that situation, it became an emergent, in my view, more fair to the aspect of justice to ensure I could conduct the hearing, but had to do it virtually one time in a year. And so I think there needs to be some type of latitude in the rule where a judge is not concerned about, you know, more concerned about, you know, violating that rule as opposed to doing what's in the best interest of everyone under a very emergent type situation. So that's my only comment, that, you know, anytime we have a rule that is so restrictive as an absolute, sometimes it can be very self-defeating in that way.
Well, let me ask this. In the eighth, well, in any of the judicial districts, are judges conducting trials and hearings from their home in family court or in the general jurisdiction?
I don't believe since we returned to the courthouse, and of course Chief Weiss can comment on family court, but I don't believe we're doing any trials in that manner, and I don't think we did very few virtual. I don't know that anyone did an actual truly virtual trial where the judge wasn't in the courtroom. Now, there certainly were witnesses that are appearing virtually. That occurs with quite, it's become quite common, but we're not conducting trials in that manner. As far as hearings, hearing calendar, other than emergent type situations, I'm unaware of any situation where people are not actually conducting their hearings from their courtrooms.
How about in other parts of the state? In the second, Judge Dollinger?
I can't speak for everyone in the second. I think some judges are doing some hearings from home, but I would say the majority are doing hearings from the courthouse, whether via, you know, from their chambers or in their courtrooms. And while I'm unmuted, and I just want to kind of add some things to Judge Breslow's comments. He's certainly one of my valued colleagues here in the second. But I think it really goes to perspective on, you know, the types of cases he presides in general jurisdiction and like big civil matters and certainly criminal matters versus in our family jurisdiction. And my colleagues from our family subcommittee, Judge Hill and Judge Burton, aren't here today. But, you know, just a lot of the subjective observations, like when we're talking about sizing someone up or even the vantage point from the judge, it's funny because in the courtroom, I find myself, I can't see people's faces as well because I'm so much further away from them. So in terms of looking at, you know, judging credibility or even hearing someone. And in family court, you know, just looking at the different case types, hearing types, whether we're dealing with adults or kids, whether we're dealing with poor people, middle-class people, wealthy people. You know, I deal with all the kids and mostly indigent families and kind of really value the aspects of Bridges Out of Poverty training and where, you know, Judge Breslow respectfully, you know, describes people losing respect for the judiciary, not dressing as well, not, you know, things like that. It, the people that I see in my court, I think some judges, like I don't expect a kid to be really dressed up for court. I'd rather see the kid in their home environment at the foster home so I can see what's going on or you know, if they can appear from school instead of coming to court. Coming to court makes the kids I see most often very, very nervous and uncomfortable. And I know we talk a lot about, you know, in our judicial trainings that we go to, well, how can we make people feel more comfortable in our courtrooms. But I think for kids, despite our best efforts, it's just it's an awkward thing. With the one, you know, exception, I think, in our family subcommittee meetings being everyone agreed that for juvenile delinquency cases, the in-person appearances are important, and just the additional formality that it shows the kids, like to get them used to, if you are coming into court as an adult, this is what it looks like, and just adding that additional layer. But for kids that are in foster care, in those cases, which again, they're the minority of cases that we see, but I just think that the stakeholders, most of the judicial officers, and certainly foster parents, kids, and all of the people involved in those hearings appreciate being able to appear virtually. But with the caveat that we do the evidentiary hearings, trials, termination of parental rights trials, and all those things, definitely in person. But I just, there's that counter to Judge Breslow's, you know, observations. And I just wanted to point that out.
What about the guardianship cases, Judge Dollinger, and in Washington, Clark County, same question. My impression was that protected persons, adult and children, especially adults who are either mentally impaired or seriously physically impaired, not having to come to the court, or someone who might be bedridden, they at least have access to the courthouse now if we use virtual hearings for those folks.
Definitely. I mean, in the second, I think on our subcommittee and with Judge Schreinert's input, she does the minor guardianship calendar here in the second, that the presumption should be virtual for minor guardianships for those types of appearances, you know, and then having the discretion to, if a party requests in person or the judge wants to do an in-person for whatever underlying, you know, reasons in any particular case, and they have the discretion to do that.
We have kind of had a free-flowing conversation, which I want to encourage, not discourage. But I wonder if we should get more particularized by looking at the graphs by topic. It might be more productive to do that, recognizing the Judge Breslow and Judge Dollinger. We do have to approach this, obviously, with exceptions or allowing for judicial discretion, or recognizing that not all things have to be fixed in concrete. That's why, by the way, I had encouraged all the subcommittees to use the word presumptive. I felt that that word went a long ways in allowing for the kinds of discretionary issues that some of you have talked about, and especially allowed the judge and, frankly, the parties to be able to participate in a different way than virtual if that was necessary or appropriate. Unless someone has any additional comments, maybe we could go to particular practice areas and talk about the subcommittee's suggestions and get into some specific reactions. Any objection to that, proceeding that way? Unless anybody wants to make fun of the anonymous comments. Okay, let's go then to the materials we'll start off, I guess, with the civil cases. And so let's go there. That would be under it's tab 2. So we have a series of events within the civil cases that were identified by that committee. And you can see that in the case of settlement conferences, there was a small minority of those favored in person versus virtual. I don't know that a presumption on settlement conferences should even be addressed. It seems like the parties and the judge can sort that out depending upon availability. So I don't know that one would even need to specify a presumption in the category of settlement conferences. If they can't agree where they're going to conduct it, there's probably a good reason not to hold it at all. But in any event, that was my observation. In the case of status conferences and trial readiness, you have the recommendation was that it be by virtual. I understand your comment, Judge Breslow, about the value of having it in person and what you try to accomplish physically within the courthouse. I don't know what other trial judges on this commission think about that.
If I may, just to clarify, Your Honor, status conference, probably my personal view, no issue with them being virtual. But when I see trial readiness, to me that's sort of the same as final pretrial conference. I realize final or pretrial conference is another item lower, but the point I'm trying to make is when it's final, to make sure everyone knows the rules of engagement, where to park, how to set up, how to have their IT people, line of sight, if there's cameras in the courtroom, what can be played, how arm's length from the podium, where to stand, how to address the court, those type of things. I can't do that virtually. So the final one in person, other ones along the way, probably, Your Honor, like everyone else, there's a real benefit to keeping the cost of the process down by doing it virtual.
So let's separate trial readiness versus status conference. Judge Newberry, can you refresh my memory in your district? Do you all have a conference in a civil case to deal with, for example, you know, motions in limine or maybe a questionnaire in a civil case with a complex legal problem?
Right. So trial readiness, and I think where that came from in this is in the 8th Judicial, most of us have a trial readiness conference. Some of them call it a status conference post close of discovery, but before motions in limine and before calendar call and pretrial. And so there may just be a vernacular difference there. Not all of the judges do a trial readiness. I do it to avoid the litigants, the cost and expense of the pretrial workup that has to be done pursuant with our local rules before a pretrial conference. If the attorneys are intending to go to mediation, they're intending to go to move the trial stack, something along those lines, because inevitably there's a buildup for the pretrial conference that then once they come in and appear and say, hey, we want to move this date, then they got to go back and do a lot of those steps again, and it's very costly to the litigants. So we do a trial readiness conference after discovery closes to ensure there's nothing else that needs to happen before the pretrial workup. So that's how I responded to the question.
So that conference would be virtual from your point of view?
Yes, because it simply, is this case ready to go to trial? Are you going to mediation? Are you going to reopen discovery? No, yes. And then we it's a very quick hearing.
Yeah. So I think what we probably need to define this a bit, but I think you and Judge Breslow are saying the same thing.
Yeah.
For a hearing in which one is, it's D-Day, we're talking about motions in limine, we're making sure all the
they have to file a motion in limine in the 8th to get a hearing. And then if they go beyond 10 motions in limine, they don't go in law and motion, they get a special setting. Because it's too long to make everyone else sit through, and our calendars are just too busy. And so I have a placeholder on my Fridays and Mondays to hear motions in limine that we set out special hearings and then evidentiary hearings on those same dates. So generally a trial readiness goes on a law and motion calendar, and it's simply trial counsel's availability, their client's availability, and it's a very quick hearing. And then our pretrial conference, our local rules require them to provide a pretrial memorandum. There's other types of things. And so we get more substantively in the trial workup. And then calendar call, they're expected to show up with their exhibits, everything that's needed to get going with the trial. Although, again, my department carves out, because of the IT issues we tend to have, we do an actual tech check day where they come in, use all the technology. Our IT comes and makes sure that anything that's that can go wrong is resolved before the jury walks in. So there's a lot of different things that the different departments do. And I think that's another issue with making some of these presumptive rules, is not every single department, much less every jurisdiction, is going to use that same terminology and type of setting. And so, again, I think the language that you suggested, presumptive, allows for those differences in the discretion of the court and the department and the type of case. I mean, there's a huge difference between the pretrial workup of a simple car accident case versus one of these construction defect cases versus any of the business court matters.
Okay. On the rest of this list, the heading is Subcommittee on Uniform Rules for Civil Cases, but then we have, I think, the list of matters associated with criminal cases. I was thinking, how many entries of plea are there in civil cases? We probably would like to do that in some cases.
I skipped those questions, so that's why I don't have a response to some of them, because I just thought it was a standard list that was sent to everyone, and
yeah,
what applied to civil was to be responded to.
Sure. So in the case of pretrial conferences, when you put virtual, that was intended to, that related to those matters you were talking about earlier.
That's correct.
You're really going to go and, okay. What is happening in the second in probate is amazing. And that calendar is almost 100% virtual, isn't it, Alicia? Yeah.
What that about, is correct.
What about in the eighth? Is that true too?
Certain uncontested matters are done virtually. There has been some change. We just got a probate commissioner that newly started in October, and there's some changes and some things that we are working out. But the contested matters are all in the judicial departments, and so that would be handled based on their department's preference. It's my understanding they're all done where the judge and the staff are in the courtroom. The parties have the option to come into the courtroom, but there's also a Blue Jeans a virtual appearance option available for the practitioners. And I believe it's up to each department as to how they are handling those. The sales calendars had been conducted by the probate commissioner virtually, but I think that has since been moved back to in person. But all uncontested matters are being done virtually by the probate commissioner, at least that's my understanding at this time.
Okay. Anything further people want to comment about under tab two? I recognize that there's some matters listed here that really don't belong on the civil list per se.